According to some pioneers' accounts, legions of gulls appeared by June 9, 1848. Many letters and diaries recount that these birds, native to the Great Salt Lake, ate mass quantities of crickets, drank some water, regurgitated, and continued eating more crickets. Ornithologists don't regard this as particularly unusual because the seagulls around the Great Salt Lake often eat insects in the adjacent valleys. But some pioneers saw the gulls' arrival as a miracle, and the story was recounted from the pulpit by church leaders. The traditional story is that the seagulls annihilated the insects, ensuring the survival of some 4,000 Latter-day Saints pioneers who had traveled to Utah. The account of the crickets and the gulls is just one of many unusual, extraordinary, or unexplainable events that have been called miracles. But is there such a thing as miracles? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
What are miracles, anyway? What kind of evidence should be necessary to document one, if indeed it's possible to do so? How important are miracles to religion? Our guest is Larry Shapiro, professor of philosophy at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me here.
Let's start with a definition of miracle. What does it have to have in it to be a miracle?
I think of miracles as requiring two properties. The first is that they have to be extremely improbable. If something were to happen over and over again, day after day, I don't think people would regard this as a miracle. Secondly, I think that miracles have to be caused in a certain way. So lots of events are extremely improbable, but it's only when they're so improbable that we think that they have to have a supernatural cause, typically a divine cause, that we think of the event as a miracle.
And what brought you as a philosophy professor to write about miracles or even talk about miracles?
As a philosopher, I'm trained to reason, and it pains me to see people reasoning poorly, just as a nutritionist might not like to see people eating fatty foods or an environmental conservationist might not like to see people leaving lights on in their house. It really irks me to see people reasoning poorly, especially about something that's so central to so many people's lives.
Some people, you know, do have these justified beliefs in one thing or another, and how do you distinguish between that and a miracle?
The issue of justified beliefs is really important. What I'm arguing in this book I'm writing is not that there have been no miracles. I don't take a stand on that. It's that people aren't justified in believing that there have been miracles.
Well, hold on. Let me get the distinction there. You're saying It's okay to believe in them, or there may have been – you don't know if there's been miracles, but we can't believe in them?
I unofficially have a view on whether there have been miracles, but for purposes of my book, it's fine with me if miracles have happened. My claim is just about whether we can believe that they've happened. So I don't know whether there's extraterrestrial life. There may be, there may not be. Then a separate question is whether we're justified in believing in such things as extraterrestrials.
Well, that's kind of an interesting one that you begin with, Larry, because I mean, rationally, if you just look at the statistics, there has to be extraterrestrial life. I mean, as Carl Sagan would say, there are billions and billions of planets out there similar to Earth that could, you know, create life, or where life would spontaneously create itself. Even though we may never have actually seen that, our logic tells us that it must be there. That's almost the opposite of a miracle, isn't it?
Well, I was interested in drawing a distinction between what might really exist and what we're justified in believing really exists. I agree with you that I think there's good reason to think that there is extraterrestrial life. But there are quite a few people who believe in this what's called a fine-tuning argument that suggests that the likelihood of life evolving anywhere or starting anywhere but on Earth is so small that we can't be justified in believing it. But we can change the example, and I can talk about questions about whether there's a piece of gold somewhere buried in the Earth that weighs 4 tons, a 4-ton nugget of gold. I have no idea whether there is. And if I wanted to be justified in believing that there is, I should find some evidence for supporting my belief.
What about the argument that life itself on this universe is miraculous? That if you just contemplate the sort of incredible vastness of the galaxy or the intricacy of bacteria or the many different kinds of species, if you just sort of look around you, that there is kind of a miraculous quality to life.
We have to be careful to be clear about what you mean by miraculous in that context. So if you mean life is wonderful and majestic, I have no problem with that.
How about
but it
unexplainable,
is every day in that description.
Yeah.
How about unexplainable and awe-inspiring?
Awe-inspiring, I agree with that too. But I think mountains can be awe-inspiring, and I don't think there's anything miraculous about mountains.
Well, I don't know.
Well, okay. not in the sense I'm using the term.
Okay, well, so let's get back to that definition of miracle. Miracle obviously is something extraordinary, but does miracle require something supernatural, which you can argue is a contradiction in terms, because if it happens, it's natural.
Mm-hmm.
Does a miracle imply that something outside of the natural order has intervened? Does intervention have to be a part of a miracle?
The miracles I'm interested in are miracles that people talk about as evidence for believing in God. So they're making an inference. They are observing a miracle, and they're inferring from their observation of this miracle that something like God must have been the cause, because only something like God could be powerful enough to perform such a feat.
So let's say there's an event that occurs only every 10,000 years, has not recorded – history has not happened in recorded history. It happens, and we interpret that as a miracle, even though it's, in a cosmic sense, an ongoing occurrence. Is that the kind of misinterpretation you're talking about?
Yeah, I think if we have the knowledge to predict that this thing will happen every 10,000 years, like, you know, Halley's Comet mm-hmm. or something like that, then this really deflates any sort of hope that you're witnessing a miracle.
And I guess, I mean, the trick would be that human history is not long enough to have a pattern, to perceive a pattern of every kind of event. When you think about whatever 12 billion years for the history, the lifetime of the universe, if something happens every 100,000 years, it could be very difficult for us to know that the single occurrence we happen to see in our eye blink of a lifetime is anything other than some kind of miracle.
Oh, I thought you were going to conclude the opposite. I thought you were giving us...
Oh, no. I mean, it's easy to conclude that it is a miracle, that it has required some kind of tinkering with interference with the laws of nature, whereas it's a perfectly ordinary occurrence just on a scale that we can't perceive.
Yeah. So that's one argument against believing in miracles. There is a philosopher named Spinoza, who actually you were discussing on your show a few weeks ago,
yes. mm-hmm.
who rejected the idea that anything that happens could happen for supernatural reasons. He thought the better explanation would simply be there are natural causes, we just don't understand what they are.
Spinoza got himself in some trouble. And,
yeah, Spinoza didn't end well.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, if we look, for example, I don't know if this is based on fact or not, but in Pillars of the Earth, there's a scene in which there's a statue of the Virgin that weeps.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, you know, it's a miracle, whereas the cause behind it has to do with condensation, particularly at sunrise.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a weeping statue of Mary for a minute, and we could see one reason why I think we're not justified in believing that it's miraculous, even if we're unable to identify natural causes that account for her weeping. So we see a statue weeping. Believers in miracles infer the presence of Mary must be the cause of this weeping statue. But that kind of inference is what philosophers call an inference to the best explanation. You're given some observations and you're asked to explain these observations. And this is a great form of inference for coming to believe in things that you can't directly observe. So why do we believe that there are germs? We can't see germs. Well, we have a wealth of evidence suggesting that dirty hands placed in wounds will cause people to get sick, and we infer the existence of germs on observations like that. So now we see a statue of Mary weeping. We want to explain it by appealing to the presence of Mary's spirit or something like that. Well, that's one way you could explain it. But another way you can explain it is by assuming that there is a mischievous God who wants people to believe in the spirit of Mary, and so he's causing a statue to weep. Or that there are 13 gods who, working together, cause statues of Mary to weep. Now, if you're justified in believing one of those things, you're justified in believing all of those things. I think, in fact, you're not justified in believing in any of those things.
Well, let's talk about why people want to believe in miracles, because this goes way back, and most religious texts have examples of miracles, Daniel and the lion and den, and all kinds of things that happen. So let's talk about the underlying human need. What makes us kind of talk about miracles or create them in various things that we do?
Well, I think before the scientific revolution and before sorts of sophisticated technology and methods of thought we developed, people would attribute to miracles simply to things that they didn't understand. And, you know, why is there thunder? I can't explain it. There must be a god producing it. So it was an easy explanation and satisfying to some when you had no other alternatives. But also, I think it's human nature to really embrace the fantastic. So we hear people reporting sightings of Bigfoot, sightings of Loch Ness Monster.
I mean, unicorns and dragons.
Unicorns. Come on. These things don't really exist. Well, why do people believe in them? They want to believe in them.
It's, and why do we want to believe? Is it because everyday life is not wild enough?
Yeah, I think, you know, why do people like horror movies? They get a thrill out of the fantastic. And it's, you know, it's probably good that vampires don't really exist, but maybe they're Bigfoots. That would be pretty neat. Or Loch Ness Monsters. It's just, it adds an element of mystery to life, I guess, to think that there are these things.
A sense of exploration.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe we're lonely, you know. I mean, human existence can feel lonely. So if you have miracles, if you have this sense of something that's beyond our mortal mm-hmm. limits, maybe that makes us feel a little less.
That could be. Let me tell you one thing that bothers a philosopher like nothing else. And that's believing in things because you want them to be true. Okay, so if you want to test whether this is possible, what you should do, and this is what I do, I imagine a chocolate truffle because I love chocolate truffles. And I get myself to really want a chocolate truffle to appear in front of me. And I wait and I wait and nothing happens. And I think what this shows is that hoping for something to be true doesn't make it true.
Although I just had a couple of boxes of Lady Godiva chocolates delivered, so maybe things can happen, see?
Yeah, but in general, you're safer believing things because you're justified rather than believing things because you just wish they were true.
Yeah, I see what you mean, that we sort of imagine something mm-hmm. and that if you use your reason, you can then check and see is it really going to happen. What about the overlap between miracles and coincidences? Because all of us, I think, have been in a situation where you just can't believe that you ran into someone you knew. You know, what is the likelihood, you know, in this out-of-the-way place? And you can see why, for some people, it seems more than coincidence that there has to be some kind of supernatural
right.
element.
First, think of all the people you haven't run into,
yes,
but you just
true.
Didn't know about
that's
it.
That's true. Yeah. Well, but I've heard people say that to me. It's such a miracle. I ran into so-and-so in Hong Kong. And
right. Yeah. And what they mean is that it was a really unlikely occurrence.
Yeah.
Right. They don't think that God – well, maybe
well,
they do think that God had
that
set things in
plan.
Motion. But look, one thing interesting is that we all have a story like that. I have a story like that. I ran into a neighbor in London once. I was once – in the Parthenon on the Acropolis, and standing next to me was someone in a UW sweatshirt who was an undergraduate in a course that I think I taught.
Yeah, but did he have a chocolate truffle?
It would have melted had he. But given that we all have stories like that, turns out this is not so uncommon.
Yeah, I mean, I ran into a family I knew when I was in a cathedral in Florence.
Mm-hmm.
From
it's,
the hometown.
It's a small world.
Sure, small enough that I – well, and again, you know, right – in the next building, there could have been somebody else that I knew
mm-hmm.
and just didn't see them. So it may happen more often than we realize.
Right.
Is there such a thing then as a negative miracle? I mean, we talk about these remarkable things and we attribute them, you know, a special, an unlikely healing or something like that. We attribute them to, or we can attribute them to some divine intervention. or some kind of divine influence, let's say, would miracle be applied when it doesn't work out so well, and it's very unlikely that it would not work out?
Philosophers and theologians differ about whether there can be bad miracles. So possession by the devil is certainly an unusual occurrence, and it's caused by something supernatural. But I don't think anyone would regard possession by the devil as a miracle. Lots of people who believe in miracles think that they have to be signs of God and of God's benevolence. Parting of the Red Sea, it worked out well for the Hebrews, but not so well for the Egyptians.
Right. Well, yes, a lot of that depends on your point of view, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you win, you get to write the history.
Yeah.
So miracles pretty much always positive.
As ordinary Christians and Jews think of miracles, they tend always to be good for them.
What are some of the earliest examples of people referring to miracles?
I think for as long as we have recorded history, people were talking about miracles. So certainly the ancient Greeks believed in miracles or divine interventions. And about the time that Jesus Christ, was walking the earth, people believed in all sorts of miracles. That Jesus did fantastic things was sort of not unexpected, given all the sorts of fantastic things that others were doing at the same time, which is, I think, a reason to be skeptical about the kind of testimony that the New Testament presents on behalf of miracles.
Are there any religions that don't have miracles? Because I was just trying to think of any of the major religions that don't have some kind of divine intervention or something that you would count as a miracle.
I'm not very confident about this, but I think I read that Islamic faith doesn't
purport miracles. Are we, collectively speaking here, as humans, less likely to believe in miracles today? And if so, does this have to do with just a greater emphasis on science?
I would have hoped that's true, but it turns out that that's not true. There was a recent Pew poll surveying people on their beliefs about miracles and about religion, and 4 out of 5 Americans believe in miracles. This is across the board. It doesn't divide people, Democrat, Republican. It doesn't divide them North, South. It doesn't divide them
by gender,
educated, non-educated. It's across the board. The same poll, getting back to a point I made about believing things simply because you want to believe them, the same poll asked the question whether people believed in heaven, and about 75 or 80% people said yes. But do they believe in hell? And now it's about 50%.
Yeah, well, you know, that sounds like human nature to me.
Yeah, I mean, what can explain the difference? The evidence for one ought to be about as good as the evidence for the other, so it sounds to me like they believe in heaven because they want there to be one.
Right.
But that's no reason to believe.
But you must get a lot of flack when talking about this subject from pretty much anyone who has a deeply held religious belief or is tied into discussions of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
How would you argue as to why it's important from your point of view that they not believe in miracles? In other words,
mm-hmm. Well,
you know, just the way we've got Santa Claus around, and you have to sort of have this at what point do you kind of pull the curtain and say there is no Santa Claus?
Mm-hmm.
And with miracles, what is it that you see as a danger for people who – for the 4 out of 5
uh-huh.
Americans who believe in miracles? What is the danger?
I don't know that there's a danger. I think we – owe it to ourselves as rational agents to try to support the things that we believe, and we're failing in some way if we don't do that. But also think about things that really matter to you. So you're sick and you go to see a doctor, and the doctor gives you a diagnosis, which isn't a happy one. And now you might wonder, should I trust this doctor? Because the diagnosis is so important to your life, you want to be sure that the diagnosis is correct. And so the more important this diagnosis is, the more you should want justification for believing that the doctor has identified the disease correctly. Well, I think that for many people, religion is very important. That's a very important feature of their lives. They structure their lives around it. They educate their children in the beliefs of their religion. They pass legislation that might prevent women from having abortions because they're religious. They might think that gay marriage should be forbidden because they're religious. So these are beliefs that have effects not just for them but for others. So you'd think that something so central in the lives of these people would be at least as worthy of justifying as a diagnosis from a doctor.
We'll get some sense as to how necessary miracles are to a religious belief when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Larry Shapiro, who is raising the question, are there miracles? When I think of Christians in particular and Darwin coming along in 1859 and increasingly the evidence after Darwin convincing people, Christians included, that God did not create the universe and man in the course of a week, but that this was a long, continuous process. And when I think about how religious people adjusted their thinking to accommodate the new discoveries, I have to wonder in the long run how necessary is a belief in miracles at all for a Judeo-Christian faith?
Miracles, if they really happen, are great evidence for God. Now remove the miracles, and on what basis do you believe in God? Well, there are a number of arguments for God's existence that don't depend on the existence of miracles, but over the thousands of years of scrutinizing these arguments, they haven't held up too well. So miracles might be sort of the most accessible and best kind of evidence for God's existence. So I think if you don't believe in these things, you're going to have trouble defending your belief in God.
However, in Christian religion, and I'm sure others too, the emphasis is not on that which is demonstrated, but in faith, in belief, and in jumping that gap. You can't see it, but we're asking you to believe it. And if you start with a premise that, well, you exist in the first place, obviously something happened other than you to make that happen. And if you just say, well, and I think this is more of an 18th century concept, it exists, you're part of it, and it doesn't mean that God's going to come in and help you to win the lottery or anything. But if you have this kind of sense of who you are and where you fit in the scheme of things, you can survive in this world, and you get that sense of who you are by developing some kind of relationship with whatever you want to call it, creator, large C, little c, and the universe and your whole place in it. So, I mean, do you really have to believe that God is going to come in and help you win the lottery or even cure your sick child in order to have that kind of belief?
No, I don't think so. I think if you want to believe in God and are satisfied believing in God without the evidence of miracles, then you're welcome to it. It's not a kind of practice that I can commend, though, being a philosopher who's looking for reasons to believe. But if people want to do that, they can do it. I mean, one thing to say about your question, do we need miracles to believe in God? We might also ask, do we need God to live good lives? I mean, what if it happened to be that that Jesus was not really resurrected, that Jesus was crucified, he was buried in a tomb. 3 days later, people went looking for him, and they opened the wrong tomb, and it was empty.
Or
the body had been stolen. I mean, suppose that had happened. Would that mean that all he had taught that was reported in the Gospels is false or doesn't prescribe a good form of life? That doesn't seem to matter whether he was divine or not.
Well, right. I mean, I've heard people say over the years, you know, I read the Bible not because I believe it's literally true, but because I believe that parts of it at least give me a good design for living.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, I mean, you can believe the precepts without believing that they are somehow divinely given.
That's right. And would that we all live better lives.
What about the phrase that you hear a lot, and that is miracle of creation?
Sometimes people use this just to refer to the ordinary consequences of unprotected sex. Other times they use this expression to talk about the origins of life. And the origins of life happened a long time ago. We don't know exactly how it did happen, and I'm glad it happened. But I don't think we need to assume a divine intervention to explain how it happened.
No, but I'm thinking of a passage, for example, in Alice Walker's The Color Purple, mm-hmm. where Shug, the blues singer, points out that, you know, the color purple is simply amazing, that this is God showing off. Again, if you say the miracle of creation, it could also refer to just that sense of unexplainable variety and, you know, just the amazing quality that is part of life.
Yeah, that's miracle in the sense of majesty or something like that. And I might look at a mountain or look at an ocean and feel awe, feel joy, and feel a sense of profoundness or something like that. And
but how can you as a philosopher feel you can even explain it? I guess that's what I'm getting at. Not just looking at it and thinking, well, that's majestic, that's awe-inspiring, but stepping back a step and asking, can you explain it, why it's there? And if you can't explain it, you can't reason your way to any satisfactory answer, then what are you left with?
Okay, there are two things we might be trying to explain. One is the feeling I have, and that explanation, I guess, would be autobiographical. Some things just mean more to me than other things. And then there's the objects that are the object of my awe. And some of these are easy to explain. Mountains come about because continents collide.
Over the course of a long period of time.
Over the course of a long
usually.
Period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So does a miracle require some kind of instantaneous effect? Is that implied that a miracle is something that happens quickly? Because if you say, you know, the miracle of life, well, we're talking about a couple of billion years maybe, and over the course of time, a lot of things can develop.
Mm-hmm.
Just according to the laws that we have observed, the natural laws. And again, it gets back to this whole thing of it's a very common thing in the unfolding and the doing takes course over a period of a long time. It has that majesty, as you say, which doesn't necessarily mean it's a miracle. But if it had all happened in one day.
Mm-hmm. I think that, certainly if the account in Genesis was correct, we'd have a miracle in our hands, right? There's
well, yeah, according to our own observation, is the way things happen, yeah.
But look, if one day we open a shoebox and it's empty, and the next day we open the shoebox and we find a fully developed organism, the likes of which we've never seen before, it's certainly an improbable happening. But we get back to the point I was making earlier about how to run your inference to the best explanation. What explains the spontaneous generation of this strange organism in the shoebox? Could be God. Could be Martians. Could be 13 gods cooperating.
Right. But again, when you say spontaneous, that to me implies that a miracle has to be something that happens quickly.
I don't know. So manna from heaven lasted quite a while. Repeatedly, that was regarded as a miracle. I don't know how long it took the Red Sea to part. Probably took a little while.
Some hours, anyway,
yeah.
if you believe in the tidal theory.
Right.
What about the process of naming saints, which, in the Catholic Church, and the extent to which miracles become part of that process?
Yeah, certainly if my arguments go through, we'll have fewer saints. Because the standards for verifying that they performed a miracle would go up. I should emphasize that I don't think that it's impossible to meet the standards for demonstrating the existence of a miracle, but I don't think they've ever been met.
Well, and if we go back to science versus, I'll just say, the lack of knowledge of natural laws. And if we were to take a scientist today, let's say a physician, without any equipment, but take him back even as recently as, let's say, the Civil War, and he says, start washing your hands before you do surgery, and you'll see a miraculous result.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, things that happened, this is more in the negative category perhaps, but happened in Salem in 1692, well, stop eating the wheat that's got the ergot in it, and probably you'll be acting more like everybody else and less like a way in which they think you're a witch. So, again, it's that can be that gap between knowledge and the event that causes it to be deemed a miracle, for better or worse.
Yeah, so I imagine lots of reported miracles are a function of just ignorance. People didn't know better.
They didn't know what it was, didn't know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between philosophy and science then? I mean, basically what you're saying is that if you can't give a scientific explanation for something, then there's no reason to believe it exists, which I think a lot of scientists would agree with you, mm-hmm. that if you can't prove a miracle scientifically, it doesn't exist.
Scientists talk about evidence like philosophers do. Scientists are more interested in thinking about experiments that would help them choose between hypotheses in virtue of the kinds of evidence that the experiments provide. Philosophers step back from the particular nitty-gritty details of doing science and talk about broader issues involving justification. So a scientist is assuming that some data justify some hypothesis, and the philosopher might ask, well, why is it? What is justification, and how does justification relate to things like knowledge?
So how could you prove there's no miracles if you wanted to, as either a scientist or a philosopher?
I couldn't. Okay. I could not prove that a miracle has never happened. And
but you could perhaps prove that certain occurrences weren't miracles by duplicating them,
yeah.
For example?
I mean, suppose that you had someone who laid his hands on a leper and cured the leper. And you thought, well, that's a miracle. And then this person trained a team of physicians to lay their hands on lepers. And pretty soon we had 10,000 physicians spreading around the world, laying their hands on lepers and curing them of their disease. I think our initial reaction to this miraculous cure would then move into skepticism that it was really a supernatural force at work, and we'd start looking at these physicians' hands, and we'd start looking at these lepers, and we'd try to figure out what's really going on there.
So when you read accounts from history of miracles,
mm-hmm.
Have you run into some where they're sort of hard to explain away, or are they always something where you can kind of figure out what it really was?
Well, if I believe the reports, then I wouldn't be able to explain how these things happened. So if I read that Jesus walked on water and I believe that he walked on water, I wouldn't know how to explain that. Most people think it's because he's divine, but that inference doesn't follow. All we know is that he walked on water. We can't explain why. Could be because he was God. Could be because he had inflatable feet. Could be because a team of gods were supporting him.
Could be because he knew something about the nature of matter that we don't know.
Could be. Could be all these things. And none of those conclusions is any better supported than the other.
Right, because we just don't have anything to work with to demonstrate or to repeat the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
There is a funny story about the preacher in Maine, though, who believed that he could also walk on water if he really believed hard enough. And mm-hmm. so he goes out to the pond and takes a few steps and goes to the bottom, comes back up and says, well, yeah, but I took a couple of steps before I went down. So
it's like flying for an instant when you jump off a bridge.
That kind of thing. So a little bit of belief, I suppose, can go a long way. But speaking of that kind of thing, we have heard fairly recently of this phenomenon whereby people pray for the well-being of an individual, not necessarily with that individual knowing about it, and the person gets better.
That's been debunked. There's been a controlled study.
Does it?
Doesn't hold any water.
I wonder if one reason that you hear a lot about sort of medical miracles is because the line between life and death is a very fuzzy one. I've been in an ER when someone pronounced dead gets a pulse. I mean, that happens. That's an actual fact that sometimes people are pronounced dead and then it turns out they're not. Or, you know, that line between life and death is not as finite and as clear as we'd like to think it is. I mean, do you think that some of that gets factored into when you have all these accounts of someone who returned from the dead or who was
Lazarus.
Pronounced? Yeah, or just the sort of feeling, I can't believe she survived. What a miracle. Because it does happen where it seems like someone's a goner and then they're back.
Yeah. We refer to these things as miracles. I think what we really mean is we're really happy that something really rare just happened. So we hear about people recovering from stage 4 cancer. Now, stage 4 cancer is, of course, terrible. And the prognosis for recovering from stage 4 cancer is very small. But it's very small. It's not impossible. And so sometimes a lucky few will recover from stage 4 cancer.
Someone will always win the lottery.
Yeah.
Not you, not me. Not Emily, but,
but there will
somebody,
be a winner.
Somebody will win, and it will be a very, very long shot that they do.
And
but somebody
they,
has to.
And when they do, they say, what a miracle.
Yeah, they will, but they won't have in mind what I have in mind.
More on miracles when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Larry Shapiro. We're talking about Wonder of Wonders, A Philosopher's Guide to Thinking About Miracles. That's the title of your book, In Progress. Tell us about that title, Wonder of Wonders.
Well, I grew up loving Fiddler on the Roof, so the Wonder of Wonders was easy to come by. Of course, it's referring to miracles. And The Philosopher's Guide to Thinking About Miracles, the subtitle, I hope would catch the interest of people who wonder what these philosophers are all about. What is it we spend our time doing, and how might a philosopher put a perspective on thinking about miracles?
Are there categories of miracles? I mean, if you sort of look at all these different miracles that have been reported, you know, are there ones that involve health, ones that involve appearances of – I mean, do they fall into kind of recurring themes?
Yeah, there are. There are raisings of the dead. There are healings. There are things like stigmata and crying statues.
Appearances.
Appearances, visions. So there are sort of classifications, and I think, you know, the Vatican has a team – prepared to fly off in an instant to investigate a miracle. And I think they've actually only officially approved of one crying Mary statue as miraculous. It happened in Japan in the 1970s.
Recent canonizations, though, that preamble to sainthood, miracles required. Any recent ones come to mind other than weeping statues?
Well, there's that one up in Green Bay, right? That involved the presence of Mary.
Was it?
And, this is a very famous
like
vision
Lord's.
Or feeling. Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, how do visions qualify as miracles? Obviously, you have to have more than one person experiencing the vision.
Mm-hmm.
But is there some kind of an inference, a valid inference that says, oh, it's got to be Mary when you read about one of these visions?
Not a valid inference. There, people make the inference. But the thing to say about, I think, visions and other sightings like this, we want to know why is it people are reporting these things if they didn't really happen? I think that's a really
Maybe
interesting
because they
question.
Thought they happened?
Yeah. They certainly thought that they happen. And then we can ask, well, Why do they think that these things happened?
And that's the crux.
Mind over matter? I mean, is it that if you think something – we all dream, for example. We all daydream. Mm-hmm. The mind is a very creative
– But we're talking about a collective thing. Now, I've heard instances where miners in cave-ins have had collective visions.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never heard it explained psychologically unless somebody says, oh, I see this, and then somebody else, oh, yeah, I think I see it too. But if this is going to be the event in Green Bay or Lourdes or anywhere where else is going to be somehow verified by the Vatican, which has an interest in debunking things that aren't miracles.
Sure.
How are they going to set up criteria that are going to say, clearly you saw it, you saw it, you saw it?
I think that they can't, and I think that's for a reason that the philosopher David Hume spelled out a few hundred years ago. Hume was considering these reports about miracles, and he asked a really interesting question. It's kind of obvious on reflection, but it's had a big impact on the literature and how people think about miracles. So imagine you have someone testifying to the occurrence of a miracle. Someone says that they had a vision, or a number of people had a vision. You now have to weigh some probabilities. So on the one hand, it would be strange if what this person said was false, because people generally don't tell falsehoods. People try to tell the truth. So it's kind of unusual that someone would say something false. But we also have to ask about the likelihood that this miraculous event really occurred. So on the one hand, we have this unusual circumstance of someone saying something false. On the other hand, we have this unusual circumstance of a miracle happening. And now we have to do a kind of balancing act. What's less likely? Is it that a miracle happened, or is it that this person said something false? And it seems like it's that the person said something false.
But you still, again...
I'm sorry. It's more likely that someone says something false than that a miracle actually explain what they said.
True of more than one person, though, claiming to experience the same
Let's think about it. You've got a dozen miners trapped in a mine. They all report a vision. What's it a vision of? Well, maybe they all see Mary, something like that. Okay, now we have to ask ourselves, what's the chance that Mary actually appeared to these miners? I'd say it's really small.
I'd say there's like no way to know whatsoever, actually.
Really small, though, right? You can agree with me on that.
It doesn't happen often. So statistically, at least, yes, very, very small.
Doesn't happen often. Really, really small. Now, you got 12 miners trapped in a mine, being oxygen-deprived, starved, perhaps praying together.
Sensory deprivation, too.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps praying, singing, chanting together, whatever. Now, what's the chance that these miners are reporting having a vision when some vision didn't really happen? Well, it's, I think, bigger than the chance that Mary actually appeared.
Well, and William Blake said all deities reside in the human breast. And if you have these miners all coming from the same religious background and having images in their head, and if it's, you know, then I would think they could all have sort of a picture that comes to mind as well.
Yeah, so that would be another way of explaining the phenomenon, which I think is a more likely explanation than thinking that Mary actually presented herself.
Are there some accounts of just pure trickery and magic, you know, where you've got people who set out to say, come look at this miracle, and it's just a hoax, it's just a, you know, cheap trick?
Well, there is this profit incentive thing.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. There have been tricks involving crying statues and things like that. Sometimes there's condensation that explains these sorts of appearances, but sometimes people just like to pull one over on someone else. But related to this argument I was just making about the miners and Mary is an important point that the more improbable the event that you're considering, the better your evidence has to be for believing it.
Makes sense.
So let me give you an example which I think is pretty startling. Suppose that you went to your doctor and your doctor told you that you had a rare disease, and he knows this because he'd given you a test which is 99.9% reliable, meaning that of 1,000 people with this disease, it'll correctly say 999 of them have it, and it'll miss one. And of 1,000 people who don't have this disease, it will say of one that he or she has it, and the other 999 it'll correctly diagnose is not. Okay, so now you take a test. It's 99.9% reliable. It tells you this terrible disease. The cure is just awful. What do? You tested positive. What's the chance you really have this disease?
Pretty good.
Pretty good? Well, now, you didn't ask the crucial question, which is, how common is this disease in the general population? Suppose this disease affects only 1 in 10 million people. So now, imagine a country with 10 million people. Only one person in this country will have this disease. But if we divided this 10 million people into groups of 1,000, there'd be 10,000 groups of 1,000, and we'd give each of those groups this reliable test, it would say for one member in each of those 10,000 groups of 1,000 people that they have this disease. One of them really does, but 10,000 really don't. So your chance of having this disease is 1 in 10,000 given a test that's 99.9% reliable. Now, how does this bear on miracles? Well, here's the idea. Miracles are like this 1 in a 10 million occurrence. They're extremely rare. So now someone testifies to the existence of a miracle. Suppose this person testifying is 99.9% reliable. They hardly ever get anything wrong. Well, because of the improbability of the miracle at the outset, the chance that they're saying something true is just incredibly small.
I see. So you're using math.
Well, using math.
Statistics, yeah.
This is a result that was formalized a long time ago.
I assume you would link the belief in miracles to a lot of other things, like the use of psychics, Ouija boards, you know, just all kinds of other things where we are looking for something beyond what can be explained. What do you consider to be the cousins of miracles?
Well, I think that belief in things like the powers of crystals, belief in horoscopes, belief in just kind of a presence out there, these sorts of kind of beliefs that invoke mystery.
Belief in acupuncture?
Well, acupuncture is an interesting case. From what I've read, under controlled conditions, it actually doesn't do anything. But then there's also a placebo effect that you have to take into account. So I don't want to deny that certain treatments might have a very positive effect on someone, even if over a large sample of individuals, we might find no real effect.
Well, the placebo effect is an interesting phenomenon because that implies then that the individual who is benefiting from the placebo or thinks he or she is benefiting is actually healing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that brings me to a question. You know, there's an Emily Dickinson poem where she says in the first stanza, God cannot be found. But then she pulls back and says, the abdication of belief makes the behavior small. She's worried that if we believe in nothing, then we may start acting in ways that are problematic. What's the difference between what you're saying and nihilism?
Well, I don't believe in miracles, but I'm certainly not a nihilist. I believe in right and wrong. I believe in good and bad. I love my life. I love my family. I think it's important to contribute in ways to helping my fellow citizens. All of this makes for a meaningful life for me. I don't feel an absence.
So proceeding without miracles, you would be skeptical of things you read about every day that supposedly are miraculous.
It drives me crazy.
There's a line in a Sherman Alexie novel where he says that even atheists pray on airplanes and bingo games.
Oh, yeah. And there are no atheists at sea in storms. Yeah.
Well, I was in a bit of a scare on a plane once, and I always sort of wondered whether I'd find God in a moment like that, and I didn't.
Weren't fast enough, or the storm wasn't long enough.
It lasted a while. It was touch and go, really. But
when you have talked to those who have deeply held beliefs in miracles, what do you find it gives them? What do they gain from it?
I think a lot of them are comforted by the thought that there's some benevolent force out there making sure that things are going to be okay, or that there will be an afterlife where they can meet family members they've lost. There are various reasons to believe something. One is because you're justified in believing it, and that's what my interest is in. One is because you just hope it's true. But another reason to believe something is because it does something for you, something good for you. So if people want to believe in God because they can't get out of bed otherwise, and it makes them a good person and provides them with comfort, I'm certainly not going to tell them that they should give up that belief. I'll tell them they're not justified in believing it, but I'm not going to tell them that they should abandon it.
Well, again, the whole premise of a lot of belief systems is to somehow jump the gap between what is apparently true and what is truer in some other unseen level. And I suppose the premise is that we cannot, given our human limitations, perceive all of the evidence or the goings-on, whether they produce miracles or whether they just produce the sense of oneness, you might say, with our environment. So it's always going to be, well, the biggest argument in the world between, you know, fact and faith.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually teaching a summer forum course on this topic this summer. It should be fun. We're looking at a bunch of different issues on which people of religious faith and people without it differ. Things like life after death, the origins of species, and other and miracles too.
Some people look at artistic gift like a Mozart or a Beethoven as something pretty divine. You know, you get a lot of references to the muse or some kind of inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
That's often been used to explain just incredible talent.
Right. I guess it might be hard for some people to admit that they're really as creative and talented as they are, and they have to attribute it to a divine presence or something. It's kind of selling themselves short.
Well, thanks for gracing us with your presence for this past hour of a fascinating and unending debate as to whether there are or are not such things as miracles. Larry Shapiro, a pleasure.
It was really a lot of fun. Thank you both.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.